I sort of feel like it's the chief being like, welcome to my branch, biatch.
Yeah. You're in my town now, chief.
Yeah.
Your task will not be an easy one. Your enemy is well-trained, well-equipped, and battle-hardened.
There is not a liberal America and a conservative America. There is the United States of America.
Good night and good luck.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the Lincoln Project Podcast. I'm Rick Wilson, your host, as always. Thank you so much for joining us today. I am delighted to be with Sarah Isger today. Sarah is the host of the Advisory Opinions Podcast over at The Dispatch. She is a former campaign person, which I guess where we met many years ago, Sarah. And she's the author of a terrific new book called Last Branch Standing. This is a contemporary history of the Supreme Court. That delves into a lot of the mysteries of how the court works, about the political and the ideological divides inside the court, what we get right about it that we can sort of see from the outside, and what we get wrong about it that we don't see, because Sarah is deeply sourced in all this world, understands like what the court's internal chemistry looks like a lot better than most folks. So Sarah, thank you so much for coming on the Lincoln Project Podcast. Let's jump right into this, because you call it the last branch standing. And I think that a lot of people would disagree with you on that. Some people see it as a full adjunct to the Trump White House. But there is a lot of noise and static inside the court that we don't see or hear that is shaping where it's going. Talk to us about where this court is today, what's happening with the direction Chief Justice Roberts has taken this court.
So first of all, Rick, great to be reunited again off the campaign trail.
Right, it's been a minute.
A decade or more later. Right. This is very fun for me, so thank you. I've been told that this is a 6-3 court that, you know, always does what Republicans want, or, you know, the conservatives always win and the liberals always lose. You will be wrong 85% of the time. And the pushback I get to that is like, yeah, but in the big cases, okay. I mean, let's talk about some of the big cases from just when Donald Trump has taken office. Alien Enemies Act, federalizing the National Guard, tariffs, and certainly birthright citizenship to come. He's lost on all of those, and those are his biggest policy initiatives, immigration enforcement, tariffs, et cetera. And so the narrative that we're told is just wrong. So I wrote the book to explain that actually the court is the last branch standing. When we blame the court because we don't like the outcome of some case, generally speaking, we're always blaming the wrong branch. Because, I mean, my favorite thing, and by favorite, I mean where I start throwing things at my TV or computer, is when a member of Congress puts out a press release after a Supreme Court decision and is like, how dare the Supreme Court, one way or the other, right?
Right.
You're in Congress. You could change the law tomorrow, you horrible Instagram influencing cretin. So whether it's Biden's student loan debt forgiveness or Trump's tariffs or two cases that we have pending right now on whether Mississippi can accept mail-in ballots 5 days later, or whether Trump has to accept people applying for asylum at the southern border, all of those are just questions about statutes. Congress could pass a new statute tomorrow. The problem is that we voters do not believe that Congress will do its job, and we don't believe that we can ratify new amendments to the Constitution. So the pressure builds on this branch of government that is supposed to be counter-majoritarian, that is supposed to be a lagging indicator of our politics, and is supposed to be part of a dialogue between Congress and voters. They're never supposed to be the last word. But if we feel like they are, it's not going to work. Our system will not function with the Supreme Court as the last word on every policy question. They're not supposed to be representative of us.
They end up becoming a micro-legislative body rather than a judicial body, because Congress has abrogated its responsibilities. And that, by the way, folks, Republicans and Democrats, when they've had control of Congress, have abrogated their responsibilities. They've walked away from legislating because it's too hard, it's too complicated, it pisses people off. You lose donors, you lose friends, and so
and for
a lot
the last
of the
35 years, the president has also controlled both houses of Congress.
Right.
And weirdly, you think that would make it easier to do legislation.
No.
But instead, what members of Congress see is, oh, the president can do everything I want and our voters want through executive order, and then I don't have to take hard votes and he saves me the trouble. And if the Supreme Court right. strikes it down in a few years because he doesn't have the authority to do that, they take the political blame. The president got all the benefit of having his Rose Garden speech, and I avoided a hard vote. So everyone wins except right. the court.
I think, you know, and in issues like Chevron deference and things like that, that Congress screams up and down about, they could pass laws
yep.
that tell the agencies what they want them to do. Instead, they said,
yeah,
that's too much work. That's too much work for us. We're not going to do that. We don't get it. I'm just a caveman, you know.
I'm just a simple caveman congressman.
And so they have a responsibility to pick that up and say, okay, we're a fully vested branch of this government. We're going to do our job. But, you know, most of them are sitting on that fundraising treadmill for many more hours a week than they're legislating by probably 10 to 1. But I want to go back on one thing with the court. Yes, Trump has lost a lot of these big cases, but he won one that I think people look at the court with a lot of skepticism on, and that's Trump v. United States.
Totally.
The Supreme Court delivered a heavy blow to special counsel Jack Smith's election interference case against former President Donald Trump, ruling along partisan lines that Trump has broad immunity for acts taken while he was in office.
This will be referred to from now on as a landmark opinion of the Supreme Court. It's not only important for President Trump's criminal case, they really have set a framework for all future presidents.
Talk to us about how that decision came down out of this court, because that, I think, that has shaped the second term of Trump profoundly in his sense that he is not constrained by much.
Okay, so a few things. First of all, this book is a defense of the institution of the court, but that doesn't right. mean that you can't criticize decisions of the Supreme
sure.
Court. I disagree with them all the time. So you disagree with Trump v. United States, like yeah. you got no problem with me. But let me try to explain why I don't think that decision is very important the way that
Please do, because this is fascinating to me.
Okay. Donald Trump is charged under four counts of federal law when he is mm-hmm. indicted by the Department of Justice for his role in January 6th.
Now we're going to hear it from the rioters themselves.
What really made me want to come was the fact that, you know, I had supported Trump all that time. I did believe, you know, that the election was being stolen. And Trump asked us to come.
He personally asked for us to come to D.C. that day. And I thought, for everything he's done for us, if this is the only thing he's going to ask of me, I'll do it.
We're going to walk down to the Capitol.
Did you recall President Trump mentioning going to the Capitol during his speech?
Oh, yeah. So that's one of my disappointments. He said he was going to go with us, that he was going to be there.
I know why I was there, and that's because he called me there, and he laid out what is happening in our government. He laid it out.
But I remember Donald Trump telling people to be there, right? I mean, to support.
So you mentioned that the president asked you. Do you remember a specific message?
Basically, yeah, he asked for us to come to D.C., that big things are going to happen.
What got me interested, he said, I have something very important to say on January 6th or something like that. What got me interested to be there.
You know, Trump has only asked me for two things. He asked me for my vote, and he asked me to come on January 6th.
That's what gives rise to Trump v. United States, and the Supreme Court comes up with this, like, I will admit, sort of weird three buckets, if you will.
Right.
Bucket number one, if it's an unofficial act, if it's something that you and I can do, then
right.
he can definitely be charged with it. And then bucket number two is if it's an official act, something you could only do because you're president, then it's like presumptively immune from prosecution, but you could overcome that if you could show basically that it was like really bad and it wouldn't hurt future presidents. And then bucket three is if it's a core presidential power,
right?
Probably the pardon power, some executions of, wars, like how to do that, then it's untouchable.
Stuff that's black letter presidential power in the
country. Right, like, right. For instance, we know Congress, not we know, but like, yeah. It would seem quite obvious to me that Congress can't criminalize a president using the pardon power, right? It's in the Constitution that he has the pardon power. Right. Congress, in theory, could have a veto-proof majority that says presidents can no longer pardon people. And if you do, we sentence you to 5 years in prison. In Trump v. United States, that is clearly unconstitutional, right. And therefore a president could not be charged with that. Okay. Here's why I say it's unimportant. One, DOJ, remember, indicted him with 4 federal charges. That's what goes up to the court. After that decision, they reindict him on the same 4 federal charges.
Right.
So it's a little hard to tell me that like the whole system fell apart after Trump v. United States. The reason he wasn't brought to trial was because voters put him back in office,
yeah.
And his own DOJ can't prosecute him. Second of all, this idea that Donald Trump feels unconstrained by Trump v. United States, I tend to agree with, because he's getting really bad legal advice.
True.
Because he should not feel unconstrained. I would call Trump v. United States part one of what would probably have to be a 2 or 3 part opinion from the Supreme Court. We see this a lot in Supreme Court decisions. They can be quite incremental. You know, we're deciding this one part, come back to us, and we're going to like see what, you know, the second and third order effects are, and then we'll decide part two and part three. We see this all the time in religious liberty cases, for instance. Right. So this was part one. If I'm president, I would not want to be the subject of part two or 3, and yet I will admit that Trump seems to be like, no, this was the only, like, he's just getting bad advice. So I get it. Trump, the United States is kind of a hot mess. I think that the biggest problem is that the majority opinion does not address the dissenters' parade of horribles. Like, so you can't prosecute a president for accepting bribes for pardons. So you can't prosecute a president for using SEAL Team 6 to assassinate his rivals. And the majority is just like, what dissent? I don't like that. But on the other hand, there's this great line, and I talk about it in the book, where when Justice Gorsuch was law clerk Gorsuch for Byron White, Wizard White, for, you know, my OGs out there, he goes in and is like, hey, I don't understand this decision. And Justice White says, was it argued in April? And Gorsuch is like, oh, my God, it was. But how did you know that? You're a genius. You're a wizard. And he's like, our worst decisions were always argued in April because it gives us the least amount of time to write them. And so they are rushed and hurried. You can't really answer the dissent. You don't get into the like nuanced footnotes in April argued decisions. And boy, Trump United States was April 25th, if I remember correctly.
Yep,
it gave him about 40 days to not only write Trump United States, but 20 other pending court cases that they had to get out the door as well.
No matter how much you think you can plan ahead, no matter how much you try to get set up for some things in life, you're not always ready. And one of the things when you're about to make a big purchase, a home, a car, baby on the way, it's not really a purchase, but you should get my point. One of those things that's really important at that point is good credit. And folks who have struggled with their credit have increasingly started turning to Kickoff. Kickoff is the number one credit building app in the App Store. Its plans start at just $5 a month. No credit check, no hidden fees, no interest. All you have to do is use Kickoff every month and pay your bills. Users with credit under 600 can grow an average of 86 points just by paying on time. Kickoff helps you start building credit right away with a plan that's only $1 a month. You set up auto pay so you never have to worry about missing a payment. And it only takes a few minutes. Do it straight from your phone, straight from the app, no credit check, no hidden fees. With over 1 million users and hundreds of thousands of positive reviews, that's why Kickoff is the number one credit builder app on the App Store. Kickoff has transparent, affordable plans for as little as $5 a month. Kickoff can help you score big when it comes to credit. Simple. You make on-time payments, the credit bureaus see the good behavior, and your credit can grow fast. They also have a new rent reporting feature where you can help improve your credit just by paying your rent on time. Start building credit with Kickoff today. Get your first month for just $1. That's 80% off the normal price when you go to getkickoff.com/Lincoln Project today. That's KIKOFF.com/Lincoln Project.
Must sign up via getkickoff.com/LincolnProject to activate offer. Offer applies to new kickoff customers first month only, subject to approval. Offer subject to change. Average first-year credit score impact of 86 points between August 24 and August 25 for kickoff credit account users who started paying with a score below 600, who paid on time, and who had no delinquencies or collections added to their credit profile during that period. Late payments may negatively affect your credit score. Individual results may vary.
So I want to jump over, that's fascinating. I want to jump over to the chemistry of the court right now, the internal chemistry, because there were a few people that I knew from the whole FedSoc world who were very much beating their chests. You know, we have a 6-3, it's open, it's an open road from now on. And they've been very shocked in the last 2 years, I think particularly by two people, John Roberts and Justice Barrett. Talk to me about what the chemistry is like inside the court, because it is really a shifting mosaic of many alliances and temporary travelers on this road.
Okay, so I am a little hesitant to explain this because I'm worried that someone will figure out to tell a president this. Presidents, who knows what I'm talking about specifically. Presidents have been told, you know, they just pick these judges based on their ideological priors, right?
Right.
This idea that, you know, they're conservative on this specific issue that is the issue we currently care about right now.
Yeah, this is the thing.
This is the thing. Now, first of all, even with that, these guys are on the court 20, 30 years. The issues that were really important when Clarence Thomas was appointed to the court are not the issues we're talking about today. So
indeed,
even on that ideological spectrum, I think it is very short-sighted. But Justice Gorsuch, for instance, and Justice Kavanaugh, I mean, these guys literally went to high school together. They had the same history teacher. They clerk on the Supreme Court together for the same term, the same justice, all of that. They're the same amount of conservative. They were created in a Federalist Society lab experiment and then released on the country. And yet, they are two of the justices least likely to agree with each other because nobody is ever thinking of this other important spectrum to think about Supreme Court justices. And that is temperamental, institutional, incremental, consequential,
interpersonal.
Like Justice Gorsuch, I call the great concurrer and the YOLO justice because like, you know, he's just Neil. Like, he just is there to tell you what he thinks about the law. And if the majority writes something, he needs to add to that to tell you, like, well, I don't totally sign on to this. Like, I have my own, you know, idiosyncratic thoughts. He is a soloist.
Sure.
You can even see that in the sports that he's very athletic. But, like, he does skiing and biking and running. These are all solo activities. Now, compare that to Justice Kavanaugh. He's into basketball and baseball. He's the team captain. He's the guy who thinks this is a group project and there's nine of us who contribute to this project. But in the end, we turn in one diorama to the teacher.
Right.
And when presidents don't think about the temperament of the justices that they're putting on the court, they are liable to be very surprised by the opinions that they get. And that's why I say that 85% of the time, these cases are not along ideological lines at all. In fact, last term, the same number of cases were on ideological grounds with liberals all in dissent as the number of cases in which the liberals were all in the majority and the conservatives were all in dissent. So there's clearly other stuff going on. And my argument is it's this temperamental spectrum that nobody thinks about until they're mad at whatever justice their president appointed.
You know, that question of chemistry has always been, you know, dating back to, you know, Woodward's first big book about the court, when we sort of got a look inside of that Reagan era court. When you look at this court, you see that you've got Alito and Thomas, who come from a different era, even though Alito was dominated by W, which seems like it feels like he's been there longer. It's in a weird way.
Can I tell you, I actually think this is also an important point. When they put on their robes, they are like Encino Man frozen. It's not the Supreme Court robe. It's the circuit robe you want to look at. That's when they first put on
Say
the robe.
Say more about that. This is interesting.
That's when they first get life tenure. That's when they leave the political world. They're no longer allowed to attend political events,
right,
to have normal relationships with the lawyers they hung out with before. That's really when we freeze them in amber. And so, yes, their confirmation to the court is important for some reasons, because it's why they were picked. It's when they were picked. So the president's reasons for picking them look to that political moment. But in terms of their own political evolution, that evolution stops when they get put on any court. And so for Alito and Thomas, you're actually looking at, you know, the late 80s, early 90s.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You could see, and that was in some ways when the FedSoc vetting process had really gotten into high gear.
Post-Bork, right?
Yeah,
like,
right.
Post-Bork, gets Bork, and all of a sudden they're like, we're taking this seriously now.
Leonard's got his foot on the gas. And as I say to people all the time, you can hate Leonard Leo, but that's hate the player, not the game. He had intent. He went out, he executed on his intent. And whether you love FedSoc or hate FedSoc, you can't deny that it has had the most profound impact on recruiting people for the bench, selecting, training, vetting, all that stuff. It's a hell of an accomplishment, whether you love it or hate it.
Yeah, I mean, I was president of the Harvard Federalist Society.
Mm-hmm.
My husband, I met through the Federalist Society.
Yep.
The friends that we had dinner with last night met through the Federalist Society. So we have like Federalist Society babies running all over the place. And I think people misunderstand it as a political organization, when in fact it is probably better understood as a social organization where you build your network. And in the book, I refer to it as the second most successful political organization in modern American history. The first one, by the way, I say is Mothers Against Drunk Driving.
Yeah, I would absolutely agree with that. Talk about a sweeping social change movement. Speaking of FedSoc and people that they thought were going to be the stars of the show, Amy Comey Barrett has caused a disturbance in the FedSoc force. Talk to us about that, because she has surprised a lot of people who thought they knew her culturally, personally, religiously, ideologically, and she has had a few wild cards thrown out there that they have not, that some of the more conservative folks, not only in the court, but certainly inside American politics, have been very shocked by.
So this is part of an overall argument that I make in the book, one of my criticisms of the court, though it's not of these justices necessarily, is about the over-professionalization of how one becomes a Supreme Court justice. Mm. That, like, we've been thinking of diversity in these very narrow senses of, like, race and gender, but we've lost diversity of experience. And in fact, you know, six of the justices clerked on the Supreme Court. Almost all of them worked in the executive branch at some point. Three of the current justices replaced the justices they clerked for. The chief clerked for the chief. Kavanaugh clerked for Kennedy. Jackson clerked for Breyer. This is not good. It makes an elite institution more elite and narrows down who's even eligible to be a Supreme Court justice. You have to be Ivy League educated and multiple clerkships, which of course means that you probably weren't married. You had to move around the country. You had to take huge pay cuts to do that. You have to have certain types of jobs, hang out with certain types of people. This is on both sides of the spectrum. And I think it changes what people on the court believe their job is as a Supreme Court justice, which I think is bad. Justice Kennedy was a solo practitioner from Sacramento. Like, that person would never be considered now. So getting back to Justice
Oliver
Barrett,
Wendell Holmes. I mean, there's
oh my God. On the Brown v. Board of Education court, which I think we can all say was a good decision, five of them went to public law schools. One of them hadn't gone to law school at all. Eight had served in the military. Five had held elected office. Like, just a wide difference in experience. Justice Barrett is the diversity hire on the Supreme Court, but not the way the right says. They're like all teed up on her gender. That's not what makes her different. You know, seeing DEI around every corner wannabes. No, what makes her different is that she didn't ever serve in the executive branch. She was a law professor. She had gone to public school. She is the justice most likely to hire from public schools, which is not coincidental, right? The Ivy League grads are just more likely to hire Ivy League grads. It's the process they came through, which again, wildly narrows the number of people even eligible for the clerkship who then are the ones eligible to be a Supreme Court justice. So I think her diversity of experience isn't as wide as I would like, but it's at least something different.
Wider.
It's wider. And I think that people, they projected themselves onto what they thought she would be because of her confirmation hearing for the circuit position where Senator Feinstein, you know, attacks her religion and says the dogma lives loudly within you.
Why is it that so many of us on this side have this very uncomfortable feeling that, you know, dogma and law are two different things? And I think whatever a religion is, it has its own dogma. The law is totally different. And I think in your case, Professor, when you read your speeches, the conclusion one draws is that the dogma lives loudly within you. And that's of concern when you come to big issues that large numbers of people have fought for years in this country.
Please respond to that notion that a real commitment to religious faith is at odds with your impartiality as a judge.
Senator, I see no conflict between having a sincerely held faith and duties as a judge. In fact, we have many judges, both state and federal, across the country who have sincerely held religious views and still impartially and honestly discharge their obligations as a judge. And were I confirmed as a judge, I would decide cases according to the rule of law, beginning to end, and in the rare circumstance that might ever arise, I can't imagine one sitting here now, where I felt that I had some conscientious objection to the law, I would recuse. I would never impose my own personal convictions upon the law.
And so what the left thought was, this is a Trump appointee, she must be a whack job conservative. And what the right thought is, the left thinks she's a whack job conservative, so she must be a whack
job conservative. She must be a whack job conservative.
And it, and like, in the meantime, Justice Barrett's like, I didn't even talk. Like, what? Like, they're basing this all on something Dianne Feinstein said about me? I think she's a wonderful justice for the court. As I said, she brings that diversity of experience. She also is a formalist. And we have not had an experiment in formalism in a long time. And I think it's important. It's this idea that, to make it, like, you know, overly simple, perhaps, you need to have all of your T's crossed and your I's dotted to get your case in. Otherwise, we're going to wait. And so it's this judicial minimalism, this idea that we don't reach down and try to decide the issues that we want. We wait for cases that come to us. And if that case isn't ripe, or they don't have standing or whatever else, like, we're not even going to get to the issue.
Which it's ironically is the most conservative position you could take as a justice.
Correct.
Which is fascinating, because I think on both sides of the ideological fence, there's this, like, hurry up and do. We've got to accomplish the big thing. We've got to get the big movement settled in and locked down. And that's exactly the opposite of her much more procedural approach on a lot of this stuff.
And in fact, we have data to back this up. So again, you think this is like a 6-3 court that's doing all this conservative stuff. If that were true, let's talk about what we'd expect to see, right? Mm-hmm. They finally have a conservative majority. They should be taking more cases. They're not. They're taking fewer cases than ever. Mm-hmm. And in fact, the ideological swings on the court have had zero predictive power on, you know, any uptick or downtick in the number of cases. Number two, you'd expect them to be overturning more precedent. There's all these liberal Warren Court precedents on the books. Like, let's get to them, right? Nope. They are overturning way fewer precedents than the Warren Court, which was an average of about 3 a term. If you take Roberts as a whole, it's about like high ones, 1.9 or so. If you just look at Roberts 2, meaning when we'd had Barrett join the court and you've had this iteration of the court, it's actually getting lower. They're overturning fewer precedents than they even were in the earlier Roberts years. And which circuit they're overturning, right? The Ninth Circuit used to be the one that circuit, always got overturned. Those liberal...
The Ninth Circus, as they used to call it.
They're overturning the Fifth Circuit, the most conservative circuit. Texas, Mississippi, and Louisiana.
Mississippi, Louisiana, right.
So like, none of that makes sense if this is a wildly right-winger court.
You know, I want to get to something about the shadow docket, because a lot of people hear it. It sounds like a spooky thing out in the wilderness.
Batman.
And we had a big shadow docket story break in the New York Times with some stuff that clearly came out of some clerk who had been there at some point, which is, you know, we'll leave that aside for the moment, whether that's cricket or not. I don't think it is. But talk to us about what the shadow docket is. Talk to us about what it isn't.
Right. So the shadow docket used to refer to the fact that it was in the shadows and nobody talked about it. This was coined by Professor Will Bode at the University of Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
Professor Will Bode has abandoned the term shadow docket because it's not in the shadows anymore.
Right.
So at SCOTUS blog, we've adopted interim docket. You can think of it as like the temporary docket. The idea is when a state or a president, when a state passes a new law or a president has an executive order, should that go into effect while the case is pending? So it's only for that interim period that we're talking about. Now, that's important, right? These cases can take 2 years sometimes to get to the finish line. And 2 years is a long time to have a wildly unconstitutional law in effect.
Right.
Or a long time for voters not to have their say in what the laws of the country will be when a presidency is only 4 years. So to thwart a president's agenda for 2 years is also a problem for democracy and for a self-governing people.
Sure.
Someone has to make the decision. And so some of those are going to the Supreme Court. Now, what the New York Times published were memos, internal memos between the justices in 2016, when President Obama does sort of the first really big executive action that was unlike what any president had done before, frankly.
Right.
So there's this break, you know, Obama's pen and phone initiative, right? It was like, well, Congress isn't doing what I want. And so we're going to have the year of executive action.
I have a pen and a phone.
Pen and a phone.
We are not just going to be waiting for legislation in order to make sure that we're providing Americans the kind of help that they need. I've got a pen and I've got a phone. And I can use that pen to sign executive orders and take executive actions and administrative actions that move the ball forward in helping to make sure our kids are getting the best education possible, making sure that our businesses are getting the kind of support and help they need to grow and advance, to make sure that people are getting the skills that they need to get those jobs that our businesses are creating.
And so he does the Clean Power Plan. And the question for the court is, do we let this go into effect while this case is being litigated? Because it will have huge economic ramifications if it goes into effect even for 2 years, because all these corporations are going to have to make decisions about implementation and investments right now. And you had the director of the EPA, this I kind of love, the chief in his memo cites her interview where she's like, it doesn't really matter what the court does because we know all these companies are going to have to come into compliance while the case is pending. So even if we lose in the end, we will have won even if it was unlawful to have done it. And the chief is like, say what now? You know,
I can
hear you, right? Yeah. So there are these memos that go back and forth. And another thing I kind of love about the memos, I don't think they should have leaked. I'm against this sort of stuff. But if we're all reading them, it's like the chief sends this long thing. Breyer sends a long thing back. All the justices are sending very long, erudite explanations of their views.
Right.
And then the last memo you see is like two sentences from Anthony Kennedy, always the fifth vote. And he's like, thank you all for your input. I've decided how I'm voting. Okay, bye. And like, that's the end. And there's no more memos. And you're like, oh my God, he's like, these other eight people are like advisors to Anthony Kennedy, basically. So Here's my beef. The New York Times says this is the, quote, birth of the shadow docket, and the narrative of the piece is its conservatives right. stepping in to thwart President Obama, who, you know, was duly elected at this point to a second term. These memos are from 2016, so it's his last few months in office.
Right.
I'm very confused about this, Rick, because in 2014 and 2015, Texas had passed its anti-abortion regulations, and those had gone to the Supreme Court, also on the interim docket to decide whether those restrictions would be in effect as the case right. was pending. And the Supreme Court also weighed in and said, also, no, those laws will not go into effect while the case is going on. And liberals loved the shadow docket at that point because they thought those laws were blatantly unconstitutional. So the idea that the birth of the shadow docket only happens when liberals lose versus 2 years earlier when liberals win. And by the way, that was 6-3 that those right. Texas laws were not allowed to go into effect. I find really bizarre. Also in 2013, 2014, 2015, we had states that had banned gay marriage. This is before the Supreme Court decides the issue.
Before Obergefell.
District courts struck down those state laws, basically paving the way to have gay marriage in those states. The Supreme Court unanimously put those on hold. And so, like, the interim docket existed long before this. The New York Times says the birth is for this Obama thing. They also say that the only cases before that were about death penalty and election law. And it's like, what about abortion? What about gay marriage? The biggest cultural issues were going to the court on this docket, and you're just ignoring it. So I don't understand.
The gun cases. The gun cases were I mean, that was another, like, constant running gun battle. Ha, ha, ha.
Ha, ha,
yeah.
Yes, dad after jokes. Heller was decided in Heller, 2008. Right. Yeah, totally. So, like, the premise of the piece is just factually wrong if you know the history of the Supreme Court.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot going on in this court right now, I think, that we need to be, and look, I've been plenty critical of some of their decisions, but I think we do need to understand it's not fixed in one place forever. It is changing even now. I mean, it feels to me like Thomas and Alito have become almost a little troll-like in some of their, like, I think they're very much a that faction's not going to change. Those guys are running in a sort of one pattern. But the strange thing of Barrett and Gorsuch and Roberts, they seem to be forming some kind of center-right block in the court. It's not as reflexive as I think people believe it to be.
All of them have really different judicial ideologies. Kavanaugh, by the way, is the justice most likely to be in the majority at this point. Gorsuch is sort of my YOLO libertarian.
Right.
Barrett is the formalist. Like, you have to, like, you know, you cannot pass go. Do not collect $200. The chief, of course, heavy, is the head that wears the crown. He is thinking of the institution as a whole. When President Trump goes to attend the birthright citizenship argument, this is like the chiefiest special ever. He doesn't get a special seat. He sits in the gallery.
Right.
There is no mention of it. If you just listen to the audio of the argument, you'd never have any clue that the president came in, that the president left. I sort of feel like it's the chief being like, welcome to my branch, biatch.
Yeah. You're in my town now, chief.
Yeah.
So, you know, we are going to probably see, it looks, you know, the actuarial tables are undefeated. Clarence Thomas is up there. And a lot of people inside, I know there's a lot of people inside the administration are talking to Thomas and Alito or trying to get messages to them like, now is the time where you might want to go take a longer vacation. Harlan right. Crow's yacht is waiting, Clarence.
Ruth Bader Ginsburg.
Right. Don't be RBG. So what do you think the chances of that are? Knowing them as you know them better than most of us, what do you think the chances are of either one of those men saying, yep, it's time for me to go. Let me give them a last sprint here.
We now have word from both of them that they do not intend to retire this summer. Justices tend to retire on July 2nd. The term right. ends on the last day of June. There's a day break. And then we hear from them sort of, you know, at brunch on July 2nd, generally speaking.
Right.
Usually the July before a midterm election. The fact that neither of them are interested in leaving this summer is meaningful. But you're right. The White House is going to do everything in its power to entice them off the bench. So my prediction is that you will see the White House, A, confirm judges to the circuit courts that those two justices would like, particularly their former clerks. And two, that you will see the White House publicly and privately, though I guess we won't see it privately, mention the types of justices that they would replace Justice Alito with, for instance, like his former clerk, Andy Oldham on the Fifth Circuit. And again, I talked about the narrowing of Kavanaugh replacing Kennedy and Jackson replacing Breyer. That's not a coincidence, though. Remember, both of those justices retire at relatively, you know, in Supreme Court terms, healthy. Like, these guys are both still very healthy. They could still be on the bench. Why did they leave? I would suggest to you it's because they believe that they would be replaced by someone who would continue their legacy.
It's like ideological succession planning. Where, you know, and character-based succession planning for
and
people
they like. And I think it's bad
for
the court.
Like
I think it's bad for the country. I don't like any of it.
Yeah.
But it's a reality. And so if you want to make predictions, I think it's a good way to predict.
Well, Sarah, I want to thank you so much for coming on the show today. Folks, the book is Last Branch Standing. I really recommend it. It is a terrific inside look at what the court really is right now. And some of you listening today may be like, oh, I can't believe that they're not criticizing and burning them all down. There's something going on in the court that we don't get to see on the outside. It's the old, being an old philosophy major, it's the Immanuel Kant thing. There's the phenomenon, which is the loud thing you see on the outside, and there's the noumenon, which is the thing you don't see, but it's the reality of the case. So I think there's a lot going on in this court that we don't. And folks, I promise to never again reference Immanuel Kant during a podcast.
This is my only Immanuel Kant podcast. I love it. This is why you run into Rick in some backwater, you know, dive bar in, you know, outside West Des Moines. And it's like, let's talk some Immanuel Kant. Tell me about the noumenon. Yeah.
Well, Sarah, thank you so much for coming on the show. Tell folks where they can get you, find you on social media.
I'm at Wig Newtons on
WHIG.
Yes, like the political party Fig Newtons. I don't know. I thought we were doing like AIM instant messenger screen names at the time that Twitter started, to be honest. My bad. And I'm on Instagram, Sarah M. Isger. But yeah, mostly just, you know, wherever Rick is, I'm not far behind.
All right, my friend. Thank you for coming on the show today. We'll look forward to talking to you again soon.
Thank you.
The Lincoln Project Podcast is a Lincoln Project production. Executive produced by Whitney Hayes, Ben Howe, and Joey Wartner-Cheney. Edited by Riley Main. Hey, folks, if you want to support the Lincoln Project's work against Donald Trump, Elon Musk, and this MAGA craziness, go to action.lincolnproject.us/helplp. If you'd like to get in touch or have suggestions for a guest or a show topic, or just want to say hi, our email is podcast@lincolnproject.us. For our MAGA friends, please, no more nudes. Thanks so much, and we'll talk to you again next time.
And good luck.